Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I spent $40,000 on shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Caroni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to another Every Outfit podcast episode. Guys, I'm back.
You're alive.
Strep throat tried to take me down, but I have more sarcastic commentary to dispense on pop culture, so I will not be brought down.
Thank God for that.
However, I'm sure some of the especially parasocial fuckettes have, have noticed, like, Lauren, you've been sick a bunch and have missed several podcast recordings over the past year.
Yeah, it's giving Beth from Little Women.
I don't know whether to chalk this up to coincidence or... seeing that for years and years I was never sick, I've gotten sick 6 times in the past almost 2 years, and they have all affected my voice. Should I take this as the universe's sign to stop podcasting?
Yeah, I think you might need to shut the fuck up.
Well, not this week.
Not this week, no. We have too much to catch up on.
We were both in New York, but truly only saw each other... for a few hours, honestly.
Yeah.
So how was your birthday?
I turned 40 years old, guys, which is crazy. Although, if I'm being honest, 39 was an equally big birthday for me because that's when I realized that I was older than Carrie Bradshaw in the last season of Sex and the City.
It comes to us all eventually.
It does.
And this year is the last year you can appear in Vogue in a wedding dress without the unfortunate Dion Arbus subtext.
That's true. And thank God I'm already married.
So I did not get to spend the day with you because, unfortunately, my husband has the same birthday, which meant I had to spend the day with him. Ew.
I know. Gross. You missed a really, really fun day. And the day of my actual birthday was the closest thing to a rom-com or an episode of Sex and the City that I will probably ever experience.
Go on.
So I woke up, me and Tat got room service, mimosas, you know, the whole lox plate, all of my favorite shit. She brings in the tray. There's a little Tiffany bag.
Oh.
Little robin's egg bag with a gorgeous Elsa Peretti ring in it. I'm already just dead at that point. Then we went to the Plaza Hotel, famously where Miranda's decorator got married.
That's right. And Big and Natasha had their engagement party.
Yes.
And I believe Sarah Jessica Parker had her 40th birthday, because even though Carrie was 38 when the series ended, or 39, Sarah Jessica Parker was 40, because I remember the show ended, and whenever her birthday is, we should really know this, she had her 40th at the Plaza.
Wow, I love that continuity for me and SJP. But I went to high tea with my friends, Stephen, Jake, and Nikki, and it was honestly so fabulous. Like, it was the best thing in the world.
Well, as we've established, you love a high tea. we've agreed you should be doing this more. And look at you.
I am. All those little cucumber sandwiches, like, I really fuck with that shit. And then we went across the street to the big Tiffany flagship where Trey halfway proposed to Charlotte. Was that even a proposal?
Hard to say, but it was shot in that location.
I haven't been there since it was renovated. And it's a huge store. It's like 8 floors. We went to every floor, looked at everything. And there's like lots of museum quality, just like insane priceless jewelry in that store.
Of course.
And then we went to the floor with all of the Elsa Peretti stuff where there's just like cases and cases and cases of it. And this woman came out with this little Tiffany blue velvet tray with like the long Elsa Peretti split bone cuff on it.
Right.
And she's like, do you want to try this on? And I was like, yes. And then Tat was like, I bought it for you. Happy birthday.
That is a very Tatiana move.
Very Tatiana move. Very like Sweet Home Alabama. I was just like so shook by the whole thing.
I thought what you were going to say was that what came out was a hologram of Elsa Peretti.
They should do that.
Honestly, use AI the way we want. Could you imagine if they just fed thousands of hours of Elsa Peretti tapes and archival footage, and then she's talking to you about what you want to buy?
That would be perfect. So after that, we went across the street to Bergdorf's, where Carrie and Charlotte and Miranda and Samantha went at the beginning of Sex and the City 2.
Her gay best friend is marrying my gay best friend.
Yeah, and they talked to that woman with that like really dramatic blouse.
Yes. The volume in Sex and the City 2 was crazy.
And yeah, we just looked at everything in the store and had a drink in the restaurant. I ran into some fuckettes, actually. Shout out to them. And then we went back downtown and went out to dinner at Baltazar. My friend Nikki organized this big dinner, which was so fun. And that's when I finally saw you.
Yeah, I was about to jump in and be like, guys, I was there.
You did make the dinner.
I did make the dinner. Paul also joined. There was an agreement amongst Tatiana, Paul, and you. I guess I was also there. But they both selflessly were like, look, this year is your birthday. Next year is Tat's birthday because it's a big one for her. And I guess Paul's just fucked. He's got to wait till he turns 40.
Yeah, that sucks. Look, this is going to be inconvenient for all of us at various times in our life, but it's fun celebrating with everyone. And it was such a special dinner. Although I don't think they ever went to Baltazar on Sex and the City. They went to Pastis, of course.
I realized only when I was sitting down, I had somehow never been to Baltazar either.
That's crazy.
It was out of reach when I was a college student. And for whatever reason, that wasn't the place I would go with my parents when they would come to town and, you know, treat me for a nice meal.
Right.
But I think this was the best first time experience at Balthazar because none other than the restaurant owner himself, Keith McNally, was there.
Not only was he there sitting next to our table on his laptop, he was DJing.
Well, to be fair, while we were sitting through the dinner, everyone is catching up. It's a large party. And intermittently, just the music would swell to a point where you would have to stop your conversation. But it wasn't every song. It would be like every three or four songs. And it wasn't music that I would align with a 70-something-year-old British boomer. It was stuff like The Shallow, which played at such a volume that we all stopped our conversation and sang along to it.
It's because he turned it up so loud when Allie, like, first does the, like, I'm off the deep end, or I'm on the deep end. Let's just play it. I'm off the
deep end. You know, the part in the Star is Born trailer where the trailer gets good.
Yeah, it was really fun and unhinged. And then our table got a shout out on his Instagram account.
I don't know if you clocked because you were celebrating, understandably. There was a six top that was next to us of people of our parents' age. And this old guy, I saw him run up to the hostess. The bar and restaurant is very loud, so I couldn't hear what I was saying, but he was yelling at such a volume I could read his lips. And it was basically, he was like, we don't pay all this money for this music to be this loud.
God, what a loser. No, it's true, though. If you weren't there to get turned up, it would be an insane environment to have a casual dinner in, for sure.
But it's the man who owns the place. I mean, you can't argue with him.
No, you can't. And before anyone leaves a comment, guys, we know that Keith McNally is a Woody Allen apologist, and we choose to look past that in the interest of French cuisine.
And his public feelings about James Corden.
Exactly. And then after that, we went to karaoke in the West Village. And I just have to say, do you remember us performing break stuff?
Of course.
I wasn't sure.
I am not a karaoke person, but this was Chelsea's dream, was to watch all of us perform karaoke for her and with her. And so my go-to karaoke song is usually Wannabe by the Spice Girls, which we did. And then towards the end of the evening, I was like, you know, I wonder if they have Break Stuff by Limp Bizkit. And they did. And there was something so fun and cathartic about scream singing the lyrics of Break Stuff that honestly, it's now going to be in my karaoke rotation.
Yeah, that was really funny. Although when I was singing it, I was like, am I going to completely lose my voice from doing this?
Here's the thing. I feel like I exercised all of my demons screaming that I have to break some stuff tonight. We had had some libations before going, but I don't know if I've ever been to a high-end karaoke place, but this was very downtrodden. Do you remember that we could not work the remote to plug in our songs because it was wrapped in plastic?
Oh, see, I've never been to a karaoke place that was nicer than that. I feel like they're all fucked.
Yeah, but I've never had the remote wrapped in saran wrap.
Babe, it's a West Village karaoke bar. Like, that's as close to rock bottom as you and me will ever get, hopefully.
You know in Sex and the City 1, when they go to the fashion show and Samantha's wearing the fur and she has red paint thrown on her and she just goes, ah, I'm home. Paul and I were leaving and we were trying to flag down a taxi and there were two bros fighting with each other. Or should I say, one was like, why do you do this every time we go out, man? And he's like, come on, let's just go. He's like, no, man, you do this every time. And that's when I was like, I'm home.
It's so nice to be in New York. It was so fun to see all of my friends. And then the next night, we had the party.
Yes, there was a second part to Chelsea's birthday. Dinner was just the prelude.
Well, and that was Tat's actual birthday.
Correct.
Yeah, that was so fun. Although, you Irish goodbye'd. I saw drunk Lauren.
Which is your favorite Lauren.
My favorite Lauren, and I rarely see her. But it was nice to see her.
All of our friends who live in New York live deep in Brooklyn. That is not a knock, but because they do, they live in these fabulous multi-floor apartments. So I feel like I should explain. At a certain part in the night, I was having a conversation because we invited some of Paul's friends downstairs. And then there was stuff going on upstairs. And then
you just left.
I did just leave, but it was one of those
fucking bitch.
Can I explain myself? It was one of those things where it's like, should we call an Uber? Let's call an Uber. Okay, let me go say goodbye. Oh, the Uber's here? Okay, I gotta go.
Bitch, the Uber waits. I don't know if you've heard.
I must have been drunk because I woke up the next morning with a top three hangover. We didn't get out of bed till 5 p.m.
I love that for you. Just because I've never heard anything like that come out of your mouth before. And it makes me feel less fucked up, especially because I wasn't even that hungover the next day somehow.
Lucky you.
But anyway, it was truly the perfect 40th. Although I still can't believe I'm fucking 40. I feel like the last 5 years really flew.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I definitely don't feel like I'm 21 inside. Like, I feel like I'm about 37.
But this is pandemic timing as well. I feel like the government should give us back 2 years. Like, we should all be 2 years younger.
Yeah. No, I fully, fully agree. I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this birthday publicly, like disclose the fact that I'm 40, because as we've discussed before, I believe on the podcast, the second your age is out there, if anyone ever writes anything about you, it's like Chelsea Fairless, comma 40 says blah, 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 or whatever the fuck.
Oh, you know who's real obsessed with that, as I subsequently learned? The New York Times Vow section. Don't love that it's like Garoni 36 and Glover 34.
I know. It's weird to have your age be like the number one most relevant fact about you. But I ultimately was like, I do not want to go into this next decade of my life being insecure about something like that.
Oh, well, I think all millennials don't have to be insecure about our age just because somehow Gen Z looks exactly our age and they're in their 20s. So we're good.
Yeah, we're fine.
So yeah, you went home. I stayed for an extra day. I woke up the day of my flight back to Los Angeles and I was like, ooh, my throat's a little groggy. Could be nothing. And during the 5-hour plane ride, it went from like uncomfortable to, oh my God, I'm swallowing glass. I went to the doctor the next day to make sure it wasn't strep throat. And guess what? It was strep throat. So, and don't know how I got it because, if I may say, there was a game of spin the bottle going up upstairs at the party that I was not a part of. So I really don't know how I got strep throat.
Well, thank God you would have probably given everyone your disease, including me.
Enough about my illness. I know that you were there in New York before me, and I'm sure you were doing all manner of very fun things.
Yeah, I did do a lot of fun cultural stuff. I saw a couple of plays. I saw, oh my God, Mr. Big, sit down.
By the way, guys, we're recording at Chelsea's house right now. And so if you hear the dog, which the amount of people when we warn like, oh, sorry about this sound, the amount... The amount of people were like, we don't know what you're talking about. We don't hear anything. They definitely heard that.
Yeah, it's so loud in here right now. Anyway, I saw a couple of plays. I saw Cats, the Jellicle Ball, which is the gay and trans version of Cats.
Okay.
Which was genius. Having seen the original production of Cats, as well as the 2016 revival, as well as the film, which was extremely fucked, I can say that this is the definitive version of Cats. Like, Cats actually makes sense through the lens of ballroom culture, is what I've come to discover.
But this is not an Andrew Lloyd Webber sanctioned version of Cats.
Yeah, it's the same exact music. It's mixed differently, but it's essentially the same. But Cats is like a musical that has no plot. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Have you ever seen any production of Cats?
No, we've been over this, but they have to pick a cat to sacrifice.
Well, it's not really a sacrifice. It's more like they get promoted to go to heaven.
Okay. Are you my parent and I'm a child and you're trying to explain where our beloved childhood cat went? No, no, no. He didn't die, honey. He just got promoted to heaven.
Well, I'm sorry. That's what happens in Cats. But I just want to say to the people that have actually seen Cats, the magical Mr. Mistopheles into memory really hits in this particular production.
Okay.
I also saw Oh Mary, which was fucking genius. Cola Scola's new play where they play Mary Todd Lincoln.
Amazing.
Having seen Cole perform in smaller like music venues doing essentially like alternative comedy, it was amazing to see them in this sold out Broadway theater. As the curtain was going up, I realized like, oh shit, Tat probably doesn't know anything about Abraham Lincoln because she grew up in Australia and wasn't taking American history classes like we did. So I tried to explain the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln's assassination in like 30 seconds.
Well, from my understanding of Oh Mary, do you even need to have that knowledge going into it? It's an alternative history of sorts.
Yes, but you have to know the basic story to understand the jokes.
Okay.
But that was really special, and
you were there during Fashion Week.
I went to a couple fashion shows. I went to Willy Chavarria, which was amazing. The casting is always so good at those shows, and I loved this one because they cast Carlos Leon.
I saw that.
Which is a real dog whistle to the Madonna heads. And of course, Lourdes was there to support her dad.
Yes, for those who don't know, Carlos Leon, the father of Lourdes. Leon.
Yeah.
Ciccone. Ciccone Leon.
But the clothes were really gorgeous. It seemed like they were trying to move away from like the suits and the rosettes and all of that sort of thing. And it was a lot of work wear. And there was this genius styling detail where a lot of the models had like tons of keys hanging from their belt loops as building maintenance workers do. So of course the next day, Tat drags me to an Ace Hardware in Tribeca and is like, we got to recreate the keychains because it's not like something they sold. They probably went to Ace Hardware themselves, but I was looking at Tat's keychain and like none of the keys are cut. I'm like, bitch, what doors are you opening?
Oh, that's not what matters. What I'm more concerned about is you're like, wait, which key is to our house now?
I also went to Elena Velez's show. She is New York's current bad girl designer. And unsurprisingly, the crowd was very Rick Owens adjacent. That show had quite a cool UGG collab in it. But I think my favorite part was the fact that a couple of the models were styled to look like fucked up prom queens, which we discussed on our recent Jawbreaker episode, right? And I do believe that Courtney Shame was on the mood board because it was like silver eye makeup that was like streaming down their faces.
Iconic. Also, where did you see Daddy Michael Kors? I saw that photo.
Oh, that wasn't Willie Chavarria. Okay, I don't even like that you're bringing this up though, because I was excited to see him. And I was with Evan and Tat and Maya, and they were like, you should ask him for a selfie.
Friend of the show, Evan Ross Katz.
And I was like, I'm not going to ask Michael Kors for a selfie. I've seen Michael Kors many times around Manhattan. But so then Tat just goes up to him and is like, my wife is a huge fan. She would love a pic. So that's how the Michael Kors selfie came to be.
It's great, Chelsea.
Although I wonder why he was there. I hope that he wants to invest in that brand, because I think that would be a good move for, what's his company called? Capri?
Capri Corp, which owns Versace, for those who don't know.
I feel like that could be a smart move for Michael Kors.
Absolutely.
But that was it for the fashion shows, although I was at the restaurant Michael's in Midtown with Stephen and Lily from Celebrity Book Club, and we saw Christine Baranski dressed in head-to-toe Tom Brown. Christine Baranski is so fabulous, obviously, and she's like the number one person that makes sense in Tom Brown.
Right.
Like, Tom Brown is for her and for Amy Fine Collins and now Cola Scola, who has entered into the Tom Brown brand ambassador universe. Like, I'm sure the Tony's look will be major.
Absolutely.
That was it for me. Although I also did see Kathy Horn at Odeon, which I thought you would appreciate.
Ooh, our queen. You packed a lot into your New York trip. Like, that's what people aspire to do on their New York itinerary when they visit.
Well, I actually made plans for once, because half the time I just wing it.
Before we get into the TV we've watched in the last week and a half and fashion stuff, may I just tell a story of something that happened to my mother the other day?
Sure.
So I was visiting my parents. I'm coming up the driveway and there's a box in the driveway and I'm a dutiful daughter. I pick up the box. I look at the label. It's to my mom and it's from Allergies Be Gone. Odd choice. Don't know my mother to have allergies, but whatever. I know that she loves to order stuff online. So I deliver it to her and she equally is confused by Allergies Be Gone, and I get myself a drink and she opens the box and she just looks at me and she's white. And I look over at the box and Chelsea, no invoice, just a vibrator and a male chastity device.
No.
Yes.
No.
My mother's first reaction, she turns to me, she goes, did you do this? She thought.
Did you?
No, she thought I was pranking her. By the way, I've never pranked my mother in my life. I don't know why I would start doing it in my mid-30s, but okay.
A male chastity device.
Yes.
Wow.
So I immediately go to allergiesbegone.com, and what you will find is a early 2000s era website. So I concoct this whole narrative where I'm like, it's a sex toy company that has bought a defunct early 2000s website to trick people, or trick like wives so they don't know, or neighbors, whatever, so people don't know that you bought sex toys.
Right, that makes sense.
My mother being my mother, of course, the next day calls Allergies Be Gone and she's like, I got the wrong order. And they're like, well, what's the order? And so my beautiful, sweet mother had to explain what was in the box. I think she just said adult products. They fulfill orders for Amazon. My mother had bought wet wipes on Amazon that I guess was fulfilled by Allergies Be Gone, and they share a warehouse fulfillment center with 70 other companies. And so I guess somehow the sex toy company got switched with the allergies be gone. But how disappointed is the person that ordered a vibrator and a male chastity device going to be when he gets wet ones? Which does sound like a sex product in and of itself.
Right. Well, we don't know if it was a man. Perversion knows no gender.
Oh, and this is the best. Allergies be gone. We're like, just keep it.
Wow, how lucky for your parents. Can really spice things up.
All right. That's all I got.
All right. Shall we talk about the show that everyone is talking about? Monsters.
Oh, yes. Well, in my illness, you've often talked about how lovely a minor illness is, which I've never understood because the past few times I've been sick has been at a very consequential time, like moving. But I had nothing on the docket the entire weekend, so I was just recovering and watching Monsters. So I was previously unaware of the TikTok movement around the Menendez brothers.
Same. But are you like a Menendez brothers person? Like, did you watch the Edie Falco limited series that came out a few years ago?
I did. And Paul reminded me that when we first started talking, for whatever reason, that Edie Falco, Law and Order True Crime, Chelsea, had just come out, and we were both watching it and texting each other about it. But I've also learned, well, the TikTok and online community around the Menendez brothers, they hate Monsters. They hate it. The only good TV dramatic retelling of the Menendez brothers is, according to them, the Law and Order True Crime miniseries that came out a few years ago about it.
And Monsters was very different than that. It also focused more around the lawyer character than anyone else.
Right. It also had 100% less full frontal male nudity in it. What I've gotten from the internet is that fans of the Menendez brothers, that feels weird to say, but the issue that people have taken with this series, Monsters, is the incestuous storyline and how aggressive Lyle Menendez is portrayed in the series.
Well, the incestuous storyline between the brothers, just to clarify, this isn't about the sons and the dad.
Right.
This is a invented incestuous homoerotic subplot, I suppose, that has been introduced in this particular limited series.
Yes. So the entire weekend, I just kept seeing like, this show is so inaccurate. The show is so inaccurate, but no one ever backing it up. I get it. We'll get into this, I imagine, in a second. The show is tonally very odd, but I'm sorry, Lyle did play that Milli Vanilli song at his parents' memorial. I don't know what to tell you.
Yes. And that was very campy. And to your point about the ever-evolving tone of the show, there are a lot of scenes that are very campy, like that scene, like any scene with Chloe Sevigny in it, pretty much. And then you get these sort of gutting scenes of the boys describing the abuse that they endured. And then you also get what is essentially gay porn with really high production values, like the prison sequence and whatnot.
Yeah, and the backlash around the show, some of it is valid, but a lot of it to me speaks of a lack of media literacy, because showrunner Ryan Murphy, this is one of the shows he actually does have a large hand in. He wrote many of the episodes. He's spoken about how they wanted to tell this story Rashomon style, meaning that each episode was told from a slightly different perspective on the case. I don't know. What I took away from it, it was asking the audience to question who the real monsters were, Lyle and Eric, or their parents, or the system. And it really feels like people want it spoon-fed to them. Like, I've seen people be like, the show should have been called Monsters, Kitty, and Jose Menendez. And it's like, okay. One, that's not the format of the title of the show. There was a previous season of this.
But it is very fucked up that they chose to introduce this incestuous relationship between the brothers when there is no actual evidence of that. It feels like Ryan Murphy were like, you know, we know the people that watch these kind of shows. They're fucking perverts. So we're making this for them. Like, this is for gay men that were obsessed with the Menendez brothers in the 90s, but also reading Dennis Cooper novels.
The apex of the brothers were in an incestuous relationship storyline takes place in episode 7, which focuses on Dominic Dunn, played by Nathan Lane, which I'm obsessed with the recasting of people from the Ryan Murphy verse, but I love that he was Effley Bailey in the O.J. Simpson series, which is happening at the same time, but now he's Dominic Dunn in this series. And the whole point of that episode is he is spreading these lies based on his own biases of what happened to his daughter, who was murdered by an abusive ex-boyfriend. And the end of the episode, which I imagine is an invented incident that happened, but he goes to Leslie Abramson's house to apologize for everything he's written, because once he sees, I believe it's Lyle Menendez on the stand, he realizes they are telling the truth. I don't know. In a lot of the commentary I've seen, they forget to talk about that part where the person who's saying the most salacious stuff admits that he's wrong.
Right. But from episode to episode, not only does the perspective change, but the behavior of the characters changes, which is so fucked up. Like the Eric Menendez in episode 5, which was such an incredible episode, is not the Eric Menendez of episode 9.
Correct.
And it's fucked up because there is no question that the actual real life Menendez brothers were actually abused, victims of incest. So it's kind of weird that the show is casting doubt. Like, were they completely lying? Did this actually happen?
Multiple things are going on, right? Where it is at times an inaccurate portrayal of Eric Menendez, but then the actor who plays him, Cooper Koch, it is a Star is Born making role, which you really see, for those who haven't seen it yet, in episode 5, this doesn't really spoil anything, this is more about the direction, all in one take. It is a 30-minute one-take scene that is slowly panning in on his face while he does a monologue. I mean, I'll call it now, that director's winning an Emmy, the writer's winning an Emmy, and Cooper Koch is winning an Emmy.
Yeah, it was amazing.
For that episode, Paul turned to me. He was like, has that ever been done in a show before? And I don't think there's ever been an entire episode that was one shot like that.
Yeah, it was incredible. But then again, this version of that character sort of disappears in the other episodes.
I think the tonal oddity really begins in episode 1, which tells the events that lead up to the parents' murder, culminating with their murder. But there is a scene, which is based on something that actually happened in the family, where Kitty ripped Lyle's wig off of his head that Eric, his brother, up until that point didn't know his brother wore a wig. And what is not told in the series, the tragic reason that Lyle Menendez wears a wig is because of the stress of the trauma of what his father did to him made him lose his hair prematurely. But when Chloe Sevigny, as Kitty Menendez, does it, it is just undeniably campy.
Well, everything involving Chloe Sevigny is campy. Like her breakdown, even when her hand gets shot off, it feels high camp because she knows that she is in a Ryan Murphy limited series.
Because it's a Ryan Murphy series, and I'll just say this as someone that has watched Ryan Murphy shows from FX and has made the leap to Netflix, I think what is also a high camp, and it's probably unintended, but you're right, there are moments of extreme violence, like when the parents are being shot, that I couldn't help but laugh because I didn't know how far they were going to go. That the lack of restrictions with Netflix means they are showing Javier Bardem's head get shot off. You see, really, for no reason, Cooper Koch's penis for an extended amount of time in episode 3.
Yes, which was in a more erotic context that had nothing to do with the abuse. Just for anyone that hasn't seen it, there's no depiction of the abuse at the hands of the father in this, which makes it different from the Law and Order true crime limited series.
Yeah, and even stuff like the brothers in the shower together when they're caught by Kitty. Again, I feel like this goes back to a media literacy thing where That is the episode where it is from the parents' perspective. That is Kitty's, I imagine, worst nightmare. But I guess people's point is that it's irresponsible to even put that conjecture out there.
Yeah, it's absolutely irresponsible.
But the other side of things is the two young actors who play Eric and Lyle Menendez during the press tour said that they were not aware of this case until they got their roles or until they had to audition for this. So perhaps this is bringing attention to a case that many people have forgotten about.
Right. But also they could have made this same series and had it been loosely inspired, right? Like, have you ever seen the Gus Van Sant film Elephant?
Yes.
So that was loosely inspired by Columbine. And in that movie, there is a very homoerotic scene where the two teen boy shooters like make out before they go and like kill everyone in their school. And that kind of only worked because it wasn't literally about those characters.
Right. But Ryan Murphy is trying to do something very specific, which is make us feel very sexually conflicted about serial killers.
Yes, exactly.
Because next season of Monster is Ed Gein, who is going to be played by the very attractive actor Charlie Hunnam.
Yeah, again, like people that watch these kind of things are perverts.
I mean, look at us.
And just a lot of people watch these sort of highly stylized cinematic depictions of sexual violence and do get some sort of voyeuristic thrill from it, whether it's consciously or subconsciously. So it seems like Ryan Murphy is being like, we see you and we are now sort of making fanfic for you, which is very dark, but also I understand that there's an audience for it, of course.
To pivot the conversation slightly
to something less dark, I'm hoping.
No, I just wanted to touch upon how accurate the production and costume design was, because I feel like the late 80s, early 90s is a very difficult time period to portray realistically, oddly enough, in TV and film. And they did an incredible job, I thought.
They did. And costumes, production design, this is why we love Ryan Murphy, because all of his projects are so well done and lavish in that regard.
However, I was a little surprised given how accurate pretty much everything is besides the story, as we've gone over, is that the actors playing Eric and Lyle Menendez both have 8-packs, which is not the body type anyone but an Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jean-Claude Van Damme would have had in the early 90s.
Right. Well, the whole family is much hotter than the actual Menendez family. Like, everyone got a glow up.
I don't know how Javier Bardem got cast in this or agreed to be a part of this, because it feels like something a casting director would have been like, you know, like a Javier Bardem type.
Khloé 70 said in her Kim Kardashian sit-down interview that working with him was very intense. And after seeing this, I believe that.
Absolutely. I saw people asking for Netflix to be canceled over the weekend. And then whether Netflix intentionally planned this or not, on Monday, they dropped a trailer for a documentary that they will be airing in the next few weeks that features Eric and Lyle speaking in their own words about what happened.
Great. I will watch that also.
Which seemed to quell the masses. It was like, cancel Netflix. And then I was like, oh, okay, they get it. They're letting our boys tell their story.
Well, it's the least they can do after doing what they just did.
Speaking of other tonally confused Netflix prestige limited series.
Is this even prestige, though?
So we're talking about The Perfect Couple, a show that if we weren't talking about on the podcast, I wouldn't have finished.
Yes, it is very much the poor man's White Lotus meets Big Little Lies, which is a television genre that is exploding right now.
So to my previous point about a casting director being like, we need a Javier Bardem type, it feels like with A Perfect Couple, the casting director was like, we need like a Nicole Kidman type, a Megan Fahey type. But then those actors said yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't even know how to explain the plot of this show because I could barely follow it. It is about an English? Is this the accent that Nicole Kidman is doing? Because nobody has the accent that is actually theirs in this series.
No, I know. So basically, Nicole Kidman's son is getting married to this girl. And right before the wedding, the maid of honor mysteriously dies.
I know that this show is based on, I assume, a best-selling novel. But Nicole Kidman plays an author that has a best-selling series that portrays a version of her husband, played by Liev Schreiber. And the whole press thing of this 20-book series is that they're the perfect couple. So that's going on in the background.
But back to Nicole Kidman's British accent. If there's a wedding where presumably her relatives have flown in, why is there not just one random British person there to establish that, like, Nicole Kidman is British? Because I was kind of like, is she British or is her Australian accent just coming through?
Chelsea, I spent the first two episodes trying to understand who everyone was to everyone else, because I was convinced that Dakota Fanning must be Nicole Kidman's daughter and not daughter-in-law, because those two sons that you learn are Nicole Kidman and Liev Schreiber's children have the most British Isle-looking faces I've ever seen in my life. They're supposed to be American?
What I really couldn't figure out is, why was Isabella Gianni there?
Okay.
Where the fuck did this French woman come from, and how is she related to any of them? Is she related to them?
She's not. I have in my notes Isabella Gianni, question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. I'm sorry, guys. We're going to spoil the shit out of this show. Or, I mean, honestly, we are just trying to make sense of it for ourselves.
Yeah.
It is revealed, because I literally finished the series and got in my car to drive over to record with you. It is a throwaway line in either the second to last or last episode where one of them goes, my dad's friend, Isabella Gianni. She has a name, but I can't remember what it is.
And she's just like his former mistress or something that is now a close family friend.
But she's having an affair with the eldest son who's married to Dakota Fanning, who, by the way, is just a poor man's Chris Pratt. He is the sacrificial bear in Midsommar. He's the boyfriend in Midsommar. By the way, Chelsea, I legit didn't even know they had a third younger son until we spent an entire episode focusing on him going missing.
Yeah, I kind of just like ignored him. But can we talk about Isabella Gianni a little bit more? Because, like,
sure.
I have not seen her in a movie since the 90s. So I was quite shocked. This woman does not have one wrinkle. It's like Cher.
Just very smooth.
Extremely smooth. And it's shocking because I guess with French women, you sort of expect them to let the age come in a little bit, you know, like Catherine Deneuve or Isabelle Huppert or whatever.
Isabella Gianni was like, no.
And I just like haven't seen her in so long. Although we didn't see that Peter von Kant movie that came out a couple years ago that Francois Ozon did. We need to watch that, because she was also apparently in that.
The show is tonally bizarre in a completely different way than Monsters is, because there is a murder. That is what caps off the first episode. And for the rest of the series, which I imagine happens over the next 48 to 72 hours, this family is not acting like anyone just died. The problem with the show is, like, Isabella Gianni will come and it's like, oh yeah, she had an affair with Liev Schreiber and now she's having an affair with his eldest son. Like, you think it's almost a comedy of manners or something. And then it pivots back to the cops and it becomes Mayor of Easttown, where you're like, oh right, there's a murder investigation going on.
But can we talk about the other very tonally inconsistent thing, which is the title sequence, which is my favorite part of The Perfect Couple. Every time that hits, I was like so happy.
You're never pressing skip intro.
Never. Like, you couldn't. It's basically like,
it's a flash mob.
It's a flash mob. It's a choreographed dance sequence
that I kept thinking would be in the fucking show. I'm like, I'm sure the wedding is going to happen eventually, and this is where the dance happens. Or during one of the rehearsal events that we didn't see, they did this dance. No.
I think the dance is just more of like a fantasy sequence.
The director of the series, Susanna Baer, who we love, she did Bird Box, she directed The Undoing, which were very competent, serious shows.
Was The Undoing that serious, babes? Like,
okay, a little more serious than this.
True.
But now we understand how Nicole Kidman ended up in this show. Unlike Big Little Lies and I think Nine Perfect Strangers, it's not produced by Nicole Kidman. But this dance sequence, the cast nearly revolted against. I guess there was a WhatsApp chat between all of them because this happened towards the end of shooting. Susanna Bear texted them and was like, I have this idea for the opening sequence and it's a choreographed dance. And everyone was like, no. But they are consummate actors because all of them have smiles on their faces.
And they were wrong. It was great. It was perfect.
Can we also talk about Liev Schreiber, who is doing his best Cotton Weary in this role?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this was an actor's choice or it was written this way. He spends half of his screen time singing. Like, every other time that he is on screen, he is singing to someone. He's singing to Megan Fahey. He sings to Nicole Kidman twice.
And I already forgot about that.
I'm not going to spoil the ending because it's so anticlimactic that I kept thinking there was going to be like another turn. It's almost as if an ending of a Scooby-Doo episode, like finding out who killed another human being, so doesn't matter. You know what does matter, Chelsea? Is the flash forward at the end of the series where Nicole Kidman has written, reveal her new manuscript.
See, I loved that.
Nicole Kidman will be back in A Perfect Couple 2.
Honestly, I'm not mad at A Perfect Couple. Like, it wasn't great, but it did what it needed to do. And even if you just half pay attention to it, which is basically what I did, it still kind of works and is comforting in a weird way.
No, I told you I couldn't get through it because I kept in the first few episodes, I'd be like, oh, well, there's surely 10 minutes left. And I would pause and it'd be 45 minutes. And you were like, no, Lauren, you just put it on in the background while you're doing other stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of Nicole Kidman, can we talk about what's going on with AMC right now?
Yes. I have been wanting to talk about this for such a long time, but every single week I forget to bring it up. I hate the fact that AMC has re-edited the Nicole Kidman commercial.
They Rickrolled us. They told us we were getting a new Nicole Kidman AMC commercial, and guess what they meant? Just a re-edited commercial with new footage? No. A shortened version. Fuck you.
And with no somehow heartbreak feels good in a place like this, what was the point of doing that?
Obviously, they're embarrassed that it's become a meme.
But like, just keep it as is. It annoys me when people clap for it now because I'm like, this is not the original version.
I'm going to tell you, Chelsea, AMC is about to get a whole lot more annoying because AMC, as well as other major theater chains like Regal, will be spending $2.2 billion to upgrade their theaters. This, of course, includes things like sound, projection, seating, and the dining experience. But also some theaters will be adding pickleball, zip lines, and bowling alleys.
Okay, I hate that. What do you mean?
Hear me out, Chell. If these activities are for us to do instead of watching the punishing amount of trailers before we see a movie at AMC, I'm in.
Sorry, I'm just like trying to wrap my head around the idea of zip lining at an AMC.
Honestly, what AMC needs to do is they need to restore the original Nicole Kidman cut of the AMC commercial, and they need to create a coherent concessions line. That's all they need to do.
Yeah, because now everyone is an AMC Stubbs member like I am, so there's really no difference between the like Stubbs line and the main line for everyone.
It really has become TSA pre-check to like the regular security line.
Yes.
But also it's like, am I going? Are they going? Am I going? Are they going? Well, who's available? What? Oh, A-list? Okay, wait, do I now go?
No, it's so true.
Maybe I'm just speaking of the experience of going to the AMC at the Grove. Also, put the bar in a convenient place.
Okay, well, the bars are another thing because if you are lucky enough to be at an AMC that also has a bar, you're actually not lucky because try ordering one drink at that bar. Even if there is no line, and I mean no line in front of you, somehow it will take between 5 to 7 minutes to get a drink. It makes me feel like I'm taking crazy pills. To quote Mugatu.
Here's the thing. We got spoiled with the Arclight bar because those were actual bartenders. I don't think that the AMC bartenders have done any studying to be a bartender. I think it's like, no. Are you concessions or are you at the bar today?
No, they've never made one drink. I think their problem is that they actually shouldn't have a full bar. Like if they don't know how to make a drink, they should just have like a canned cocktail that they like hand to you or something.
I'm going to say something controversial. Go to a Regal theater. They got that situation at Regal. They got 40X, Chelsea, and they have an amazing bar and they have Dippin' Dots at the concession stand.
What more could you ask for?
All right.
Shall we get into some Gen X news?
Yes. I know this is weeks old, but I'm sorry, guys. We have to talk about the fact that while we were in New York, we learned through an Instagram post that Dave Grohl fathered a child outside of his marriage. On September 10th, he posted, "I've recently become the father of a new baby daughter, born outside of my marriage. I plan to be a loving and supportive parent to her. I love my wife and my children, and I am doing everything I can to regain their trust and earn their forgiveness. We're grateful for your consideration towards all the children involved as we move forward." That is the most passive language I've ever heard in my life. A child just sort of happened upon me and I've learned it's mine.
Yeah, I feel bad for his family. I'm sure he didn't want this to be public, but clearly it was on the verge of coming out.
But that's the thing, is that statement came out of nowhere, where it did feel like there would be a tabloid reveal of the baby mama or the child. But we still do not know who the mother is or how old the child is. This child could be 17. We don't know. The language is that vague.
But I feel like in these situations, you never actually really know what's going on. Like, for all we know, Dave Grohl and his wife could have an open marriage. And this was just like an oops.
Sure, but I feel like even the most open-minded of wives and situations, I think the chillness stops with the fathering of a child.
Oh, of course.
Also, I'm sorry, you're 55, cheating on your wife, I imagine on tour, raw-dogging women without a vasectomy? What's wrong with you?
No, that's true.
Thank you, Chelsea.
That's not right. How hard is it to get a vasectomy?
I noticed after John Mulaney announced he was getting divorced from his wife, there was a real prayer circle around, like, okay, John Mulaney failed us. I guess we just have Dave Grohl and Keanu Reeves left. And now that, like, Dave Grohl has fallen, it's like, all right, Keanu's the only good guy left.
Maybe he is, because I feel like we should also be getting into Perry Farrell.
You're right. So also, while we were in New York, I woke up after our Balthazar karaoke night to look on my timeline and see videos of Perry Farrell unprompted attacking Dave Navarro during one of the Jane's Addiction reunion shows. Yeah, not great.
I've never been the biggest Jane's Addiction head or followed either of them particularly closely. Although Perry Farrell has been known to be like an alcoholic addict, right?
Unstable for sure. But then again, he did play in Lollapalooza year after year. It's a bizarre video because something clearly sets him off. He yells, "Fuck you," and then throws a punch at Dave Navarro while they were performing the song Ocean Size. It's the oddest video to watch because Dave Navarro doesn't even get mad. Like, you can tell even from watching this grainy video that he's as confused as us of, like, why is this happening right now? Like, he doesn't even try to fight Perry Farrell.
Yeah.
He just moves away and continues playing, which it's like, is this normal for you?
I get the vibe that this was the last straw for everyone in the band.
Yeah, so a few days later, the band released a statement. I imagine this was their management that released the statement, saying that they were canceling the rest of the North American tour dates. So very glad that friend of the show, Jessica Glasscock, got to see them when she was in LA in August. But the band issued three statements, because that was the official band statement. Then the other band members that weren't Perry Farrell issued their own statement saying, "Due to a continuing pattern of behavior and the mental health difficulties of our singer Perry Farrell, we have come to the conclusion that we have no choice but to discontinue the current U.S. tour." Then Perry Farrell released his own statement saying, "This weekend has been incredibly difficult, and after having the time and space to reflect, it is only right that I apologize to my bandmates, especially Dave Navarro. Unfortunately, my breaking point resulted in inexcusable behavior, and I take full accountability for how I chose to handle the situation." Farrell's wife has taken to Instagram saying that he is seeking help from an ENT, an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and a neurologist. Rough. It's not great. I wonder if they got into band practice, because there's a lot of money on the line. You know, they put the ticket and tour sales announcements way ahead of practicing as a band, and I wonder if they got to band practice and were like, ooh, he's not ready to tour, but they had already sold a shit ton of tickets.
Yeah, I think that's highly probable. One thing that was also shocking to me, just because I haven't seen Perry Farrell in a while, is how worked over this man looks. Like, he is completely yassified, like Isabella Gianni. Like, I feel like it goes beyond Botox. Like, he may have gotten a facelift or something.
I could see that.
Did you not notice this? Am I crazy?
I keep more abreast with Dave Navarro, not in the last few years. I was more surprised he was on tour, because the last time I checked in with Dave Navarro, you know, Chelsea, as I do from time to time, he's a long COVID guy. So I was Yeah, I was surprised to see him on tour. He was one of those guys that like a year or two ago was like, I am so fatigued, I can't do anything.
Oh, God, that's horrible.
But he was evidently killing it on stage.
Okay, well, good for him. That sucks. I've always liked Dave Navarro.
Honestly, I will pay for Paramount Plus if I can be assured that the short-lived reality show of him and Carmen Electra, where they're planning their wedding,
yes,
is available.
Oh, of course, with the colonic episode specifically that is burned in my brain for some reason. Anyway, moving on, shall we talk about some fashion news?
Yes, again, this might be a little stale, but sorry, I couldn't speak last week, and we need to speak on these things.
Yeah, because who else is going to talk about Karen Elson's star-studded wedding, officiated by Patti Smith?
I was unaware that Karen Elson had gotten married, and when I clicked on the link, I was very stunned to learn that she married someone that used to date my friend.
Who? You can bleep out the name. Oh, okay.
This is her longtime boyfriend, who also listens to the podcast.
So he's a modelizer, is what you're saying.
He's a bit of a modelizer. It's just very weird. A model whose ads I used to rip out of Vogue magazine and like keep in a case, to learn that she married a man whose apartment I've had dinner in multiple times. It's just very surreal for me.
So he owns Electric Lady Studios, which is why this wedding, which took place in New York at Electric Lady Studios, had really the who's who of both the music world and the fashion world. We got Travis and Taylor. We also got Karlie Kloss. So Kayla reunion. Also, she was wearing a maroon dress. I don't know if that means anything to you, but someone out there will know what I'm talking about.
Because of you, I do understand the subtext of this, or just the text of it.
Also, Lana Del Rey and her alligator tour guide boyfriend came. And then on the fashion side, we had, like, you know, Grace Coddington, tons of models.
Pat McGrath, of course, did the makeup for everyone.
Alessandro Michele designed her wedding dress, the first wedding dress he's done for Valentino, which was gorgeous and felt very her. I feel like Karen Elson has always been a bit of a vintage girly. This dress felt vaguely Edwardian.
For sure. And her last wedding to her ex-husband, Jack White, if my mid-aughts indie sleaze brain remembers correctly, was on a canoe in the Amazon?
Something like that. Yeah. Very different vibe. Who else was there? I saw Jim Jarmusch there. I loved reading the Vogue weddings piece about it. Did you read that?
Of course.
And she also did the Gwen Stefani thing and had two weddings. Like, she had previously had a wedding in Nashville for like her Nashville friends. And then this was her big New York wedding.
Right. What also sticks out in my mind about Karen Elson and Jack White's marriage and their supposedly acrimonious divorce was that TMZ, like 10 years ago, somehow got their hands on an angry email that Jack White had written to Karen Elson, where he was very upset that their kids were enrolled in the same school that the Black Keys kids were, because he was right. Like, now I have to talk to these guys for the next decade. I fucking hate them.
To be fair, that would suck.
I went back to find it, and the other thing he kept saying was like, everyone's gonna lump us together.
Well, they've already been lumped together.
Well, but I love the idea of like in a PTA context of like, you're a music guy and he's a music guy, like maybe you guys want to handle the talent show this year. Anyway, congrats to them.
Yeah, good for them. I'm happy for Karen. I've always loved her and I wish her nothing but happiness. Moving on, we have a bunch of Vogue-related news. We did talk about the current state of American Vogue in our last Hotline episode, and that came out maybe like a day before the incredible Lady Gaga cover, which I just want to touch upon briefly because I feel like this is the best cover they've had in years. And of all of the sort of fake Avedon covers that they do, I feel like this is the best version of that. And I can't remember the last time I've like run out to buy an issue of Vogue, except for, wait, I guess I'm lying. I did do that with the Nicki Minaj issue, but that was less about the photograph and more about the choice of cover star.
See, my mom has had a subscription since I can remember, and I'm sure she will never cancel it. I peruse it when I'm over. But who knew that this editorial would be a little amuse-bouche for the Harlequin Companion album?
I know. I am a little scared about that.
Well, because also the cover art is like, sees one Nan Golden photo.
I don't even know how to describe the cover art. It's more just like the one snippet of a song that she shared on her Instagram recently did scare me a little bit. It felt very like rock musical, like rock and roll inspired Broadway musical. But we'll see.
At some point, she's going to record a rock opera album.
I think she already has. I think that's what we're about to find out. Beyond their fantastic October cover, Vogue has recently launched a new app. Vogue Runway is dead. RIP Vogue Runway.
I saw that. However, it still has the most annoying sign-in process.
Yeah, that hasn't changed.
This is what I need from the Vogue app, which is if you are now going to add a Twitter-esque timeline where all of your contributors are updating in real time what's happening during Fashion Week, I need to not have to be logged out every time I leave the app. And then I have to, like logging into Resy, it's like I have to put my email, then I get a link to my email, then the link takes me back into the app, and then I can log in.
Yeah, you always have to sign in through an email link, which is fully crazy.
Not even our banking apps have this much authentication. What do you think? Someone's hacking into my Vogue app?
No, I know. I am really glad that they consolidated the content on Vogue Runway and the content on the website because that needed to happen, right? Like, yes. It was insane that I couldn't read articles from Vogue on the Vogue Runway app.
Right.
So they fixed that problem. I don't know if we needed the contributors section. It does feel like they're trying to make their own Instagram or something.
Yeah, it's a cross between Threads, Instagram.
I don't think we need the social networking component of it because it's like I already follow the people I care about on Instagram. So it's almost like redundant content.
Making people go to a different app for a new social media thing is very difficult, but like we're already in there because we want to see the runway images. I'm intrigued to see how this contributor section evolves post Fashion Week.
One thing that I do really, really love is the new Runway Genius game. Have you played this?
I haven't because you told me where to find it and I tried to and I couldn't find it.
Wait, what? You had one job. I went out of my way to be like, bitch, play Runway Genius.
And I looked at it and I said, I can't find it. And I was like, well, more Perfect Couple to watch.
Oh my God. Okay, so basically what it is, it's a game where you have 1 minute to correctly identify 20 runway images.
Oh God, this is made for you.
And you're quizzed on different things. Like one of them was just about models. So you're just identifying models. One is all about little black dresses and you just pick the designers. And then based on your score, they assign you a row. Like, are you first row? Are you second row? Are you third row? I am currently second row.
Whoa.
With an 80% accuracy average.
So you need to be 90% and above to be in the first row?
Okay, this is my problem. The only one where I have correctly identified all 20 in a minute was the model one. Because that, it's like you look at someone's face and you just make a call. With the fashion show images, sometimes it takes you a second to identify some random like Matthew Williamson runway image from 2001.
Right.
It's not just about looking at the dress. It's like you have to sometimes look at like the handbags or the set or that sort of thing to identify it. And it's not enough time. Vogue people, if you're listening, we either need more time or less looks, because I cannot be second row.
Sorry, I'm imagining that they start like online games. They start introducing in-app purchases, and it's like you find out at the end of the month, it's like, I have spent $2,000 buying in-app coins to help my chances at Runway Genius.
I would spend a dollar a day if I could get 30 more seconds. No question.
Oh my God.
No, it's so fun. It's literally like I do it every single day, and it also keeps track of like how many consecutive days you've done it. So you are on like a streak.
Wow, this is really Wordle for people who are us.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. So I love the new app for that reason alone.
Do we want to get into this moment that happened during New York Fashion Week where Naomi Campbell kind of dissed Anna Wintour?
Anna was scheduled to give an award to Naomi Campbell at Harlem's Fashion Rose Annual Style Awards. Naomi did not make it in time. She was late. When Anna was scheduled to give her this award and Anna had to leave. So because she had no one to give the award to, during her speech, she made a joke about Naomi Campbell's notorious tardiness. Let's just play a clip of it here.
I am a very punctual person, and I have the honor of presenting tonight to someone who is often late.
Which is legendary, and also Anna Wintour's brisk appearances at events is also legendary and well documented. She wasn't like, fuck this bitch. She is.
No, she made a joke. Like, what is she supposed to do? It's an awkward position to be in. So when Naomi finally showed up, Samira Nasser, who is the editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar, is the one that actually presented her with the award because she was still there. And when Naomi got the award, she said this.
Everything's meant to work out the way it's meant to work out. It wasn't my choice to have the other lady. I'd much rather have this. So
thank you. The other lady is just so disrespectful.
It's so rude because it's like Anna wasn't actually making fun of you. Like, she wasn't trying to be a bitch. She was just trying to sort of like diffuse the tension of the situation. It reminded me of this one time on The View when Meghan McCain came back from her maternity leave and she said to Joy, like, Joy, I know you missed me. And Joy was like, no, actually, I didn't. And she was like, oh my God, I was joking. Like, that's so mean. I feel like this is like that.
Unlike us who got to see the video clips of this happening, I'm sure when Naomi Campbell arrived and was like, where's Anna? They were like, oh, she had to leave. And she made a joke about you being late.
Yeah, I feel like she probably didn't actually see what Anna actually said.
There's no way, because it was not televised either. The only way that we have this clip is someone in the audience filmed it. It's also Fashion Week. Anna Wintour is someone who's overly scheduled. She could have just left and not presented the award.
She could have, but she fulfilled her commitment whether or not Naomi was there or not.
That's the Anna Wintour guarantee.
Team Anna in this situation.
Which I think there's no better transition into the new Hulu series In Vogue, the 90s.
Have you watched all of them? Because I think I just watched the first 4 or 5. I haven't watched the hip hop one yet.
I've watched all of them, but here's the thing. I loved it, but when I saw In Vogue, the 90s, I guess I had thought it was more these touchstone moments
in Vogue
that happened in Vogue. And the first 3 episodes hit upon that, but it's more like those CNN docuseries, the 90s.
Yes.
Than anything else, which I'm down.
Yeah, I'm down for that. They should be making video content like this. The subject matter certainly was not new to me, especially as we have both just watched the Supermodels show on Apple TV Plus and also the Galliano documentary that came out recently. It's covering a lot of the same ground, but what is exciting to me about it is the commentary from various fashion luminaries and the occasional tea that you get from them. Like, I loved Camilla Nickerson talking about styling the Freedom 90 video and how when she went to meet with David Fincher, what was he editing?
He was editing Alien 3.
So good. Or I loved Edward Enninful disclosing that Kate Moss can't wink.
Yeah.
Like, that stuff is great. And of course, these fashion people, like, there's so many great personalities. Of course, Carlene Cerf de Dudziel was the star of this, no question.
I hate grunge.
I hate it when rich people pretend to dress poor.
I hate it when rich people dress poor. Glamour.
She's so funny. Also, I always thought that Tawny Goodman was like this beacon of minimalist style. So to see her in this high camp, like nautical setup.
In her house.
Yes, in this very preppy environment threw me. I'm like, did I never understand this woman at all?
Well, it's also the most ostentatious, lugubrious use of a scarf that she has. Like, she has what seems to be multiple of the same scarf all tied together around her neck.
She needs to drop the scarf tying tutorial in the Vogue contributors section. That I will watch.
What I found interesting about this was the way they presented certain events, in the sense that they totally glossed over Anna Wintour's actual first cover for Vogue, which had the LaCroix sweater and the girl in jeans, and the printer thought it was the wrong cover. And instead, if you don't know what the first cover is, they really make it seem like Madonna on the cover of Vogue in 1989 was Anna Wintour's first cover.
Yes, and I see how that cover was very different for Vogue and very different for Madonna, but just like not a great Madonna magazine cover. I'm sorry, not a great shoot.
Bad editorial.
Bad styling. Like, not good, which is what is totally bizarre, especially when you think about the insane covers that like Vanity Fair did with Madonna, for example.
And I understand why they're telling that story of the sort of past is prelude type of thing, that it was setting up where Vogue was going to go in the 90s, because Anna Wintour tells a story of being on the Concorde and sitting next to a guy, and the guy mentions Madonna and how Madonna's it, but that would never be in Vogue. And she was like, I'll prove you wrong. I'll do the most boring Madonna cover you've ever seen.
Yeah, literally.
What's also interesting about this documentary is obviously it is looking back at the 90s and Vogue's impact through 2024 eyes. So a lot of this stuff is not exactly how it happened, but I am surprised with hindsight that none of them are like, we called it wrong with grunge. They are all upfront. All of the editors are like, we hated grunge. And we begrudgingly did that editorial, mostly because Grace Coddington tricked us.
Yeah, I get the vibe that at times it was really like Grace Coddington against the world, and maybe to a lesser degree, Andre Leon Talley. But yes, Anna Wintour, and certainly like her main girls, you know, Tawny, Hamish Bowles, like these are not grunge people. They're not anti-fashion. They idealize a very traditional idea of glamour. But yes, the words I was wrong should have been uttered at some point.
Yes. And a lot of these things 30 years later are easy to go, well, this was happening and this was happening, when in reality, they were all happening in tandem with each other. Because they also make a huge point about like, actresses didn't want to be glamorous. That's why we had to have models, because the actresses, they had a whole thing where they weren't going to be taken seriously if, you know, they didn't dress down the red carpet. It's like, guys, Winona Ryder, I look this up. I'm like, okay, when did Winona Ryder, the quote unquote queen of grunge and Gen X, when did she first appear on Vogue? In 1993. They make it seem like Gwyneth Paltrow's first cover in 95. It's like, that's when actresses started going into the magazine.
Yeah, no, I found that to be crazy as well. Also, I love Grace Coddington just being like, I hate working with celebrities. I just want to work with models, which makes sense because celebrities are basically models without formal training.
Yes, and she correctly said to Anna, this is the beginning of the end.
And also, I love the fact that she debunked Linda Evangelista's claim that she doesn't get out of bed for less than $10,000 a day. She's like, this bitch got out of bed for Vogue for less than $10,000 a day all the time.
What she says actually is, Christy and I have a saying, we don't get out of bed for less than $10,000. Christy Turlington took none of the heat for that quote. It was all on Linda Evangelista. But I did find this like slightly duplicitous, where Anna Wintour's like, I tried to take that line out to protect her, but I ultimately didn't. It's like, okay, all right.
Well, thank God she did it. Because it would have been sad if we had been deprived of that. Also, not only is this series not really about Vogue, it's at times more about British Vogue and also ID.
Right.
And the face in the British alternative fashion magazines, which they correctly credit as being the ones that sort of initially ushered in the grunge look or the anti-fashion look in the 90s.
And also the sort of symbiotic relationship, as told by Edward Edinfull, that in looking at Vogue and what Anna Wintour was doing, it was like, well, why don't we do our thing with high fashion models and put them on the cover?
Right. But if I was just watching this, like the Corinne Day shoot with Kate Moss, the lingerie shoot that is discussed, that was in British Vogue. That was not in American Vogue.
So that's what I thought.
It gets very confusing. It's like Vogue would have never run that. British Vogue was ahead of American Vogue at the time in terms of fashion. Although, when you do watch this, at times you are reminded of those incredible 90s shoots, like the Ellen von Unworth one that was based on the piano.
Yes.
That we see briefly. And you know, we got that hotline call recently that was like, when was American Vogue actually good? And it's like, we also should have mentioned those Ellen von Unworth shoots, the work that she did in the early 90s for Vogue was incredible. But the best thing actually was probably those Irving Penn photos in those still life specifically.
Right.
Just
right.
Want to retroactively acknowledge that. But yes, not much about the magazine. More talk about ID and the influence that that had.
And I'm sure, dear fuckheads, you're probably wondering, wow, they've gotten really deep into the episode without talking about Fashion Week. But there is a reason is Fashion Week has turned into Fashion Month and we've missed a good part of it. So we've decided to do something I don't think we've ever done before, which is condense our feelings about this most current Fashion Month in an upcoming VIP episode.
Which should come out next week sometime.
Crossing fingers, whenever the last day of Paris Fashion Week is.
So check that out or don't. Either way, we will be back next week.
All right, guys. Until then, love ya.
Actually, I think it would be better if you Irish goodbye'd.
Oh.
Bye, guys.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.